Well, welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and I hope you enjoyed that last piece. We're playing these every day till Friday. The documentary that was produced by the students who were taking the course that I was teaching along with Stephanie Mavronis at UMBC, called Freddie Gray, Public Policy, History and Narrative, How Did We Get Here? As part of the American Studies radio series. So we hope you're enjoying that, and the students put a lot of work into it. But let's switch now gears to where we are here, talking about this presidential election, but more importantly about what is happening in this election in terms of independent voters and other voters and citizens in this country seemingly turning their back on the establishment in large numbers. And clearly a lot of moderates in both parties who are sticking with the establishment. Even they are disgruntled many ways by many of the polls. But you're seeing right now, I was really taken by a poll as I was walking past a TV screen yesterday morning and showing what would happen with Trump versus Sanders and Trump versus Clinton. And the numbers shift. I mean, Clinton wins, but barely. But the shift was interesting because much of that came from independent voters who would vote for Trump over Clinton, but I would vote for Sanders over Trump. Now, we're not doing a numbers game this hour so much as – just wanted to point that out, just so much as talking about what is happening in the American public. Is there a synergy here in America that can touch one another? Or does race and racism separate them so deeply they cannot touch? And what we're saying about our future. We are joined here by our panel. Once again, Bill Fletcher joins us. Bill Fletcher Jr. is a senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies, editorial member of blackcommentator.com, co-author of The Indispensable Ally, Black Workers and the Formation of the Congress of Industrial Organizations, and Solidarity Divided, The Crisis in Organized Labor and a New Path Towards Social Justice. Welcome back, Bill. Always good to have you with us.
Always glad to be on the program.
John Duda in the studio here, co-founder of BASE, co-founder of and collective member of Red Emma's Bookstore and Coffee House in Baltimore. John, good to have you here as well.
Great to be here, Mark.
Zoe Carpenter joins us by phone. The nation's assistant Washington editor. Zoe, welcome back. Good to have you with us as well.
Thanks for having me.
And y'all can join us here at 410-319-8888. You can email us at mark@marketsteinershow.org. You can also tweet us at Mark Steiner, log on to our Facebook pages, 410-319-8888. So, Bill, let me start with you. This, to me, it's just such an interesting election. I feel like there's an arc from 2008, maybe even before. If we go back to Jesse Jackson, but 2008 with Barack Obama's emotional victory and campaign because of what he represented to many people, and where we are now with people just in droves, kind of fed up with the establishment, fed up with dynasties. And what do you think is this formation of the body politic means now?
I think that that there's a number of things that are unfolding, Mark, and one is potentially a political realignment, both on the Democratic side and the Republican side, and that this being set up, the sense of anxiety that people are feeling, is directly related to several different factors, and it depends on what sunglasses you're wearing that determines what side of the fence that you ultimately end up on. It has to do with the change in the economy over the last 40 years and what this has meant for the so-called American dream with regard to white people. It has to do with the changing demographics that we've also been experiencing since 1965. And it also has to do with an interpretation of the gridlock that we've experienced over the since 2009. And this last point is very, very important because the Republicans, I would argue, have been very successful in basically presenting a narrative that Washington is being held up by this almost inexplicable, stupid gridlock, as opposed to that there have been active moves that essentially constitute sabotage ever since Obama took over that explain a lot of what we're experiencing. So all of this is going on, and people are looking at it, and many of the Trump supporters are deeply fearful that they are losing any possibility of grabbing onto the American dream.
And I think, Zoe, that fear of losing the American dream, and I think the fear of many people realizing they may never even get to the American dream, is, as Bill is saying, at the heart of all this.
I would agree with that. I would take that analysis of the narrative about gridlock a little bit further, though.
Okay.
I think not only has the GOP painted the gridlock as being sort of apolitical or objective, but also that it's just it's a normal function of government, and therefore government is bad, and the only way to get rid of gridlock is to do away with the power of the federal government, to do away with establishment politicians. And so it shouldn't be at all surprising that the outcome of that narrative is support for someone like Trump, who is, you know, the anti-politician in a way. But back to the question about the economy, you have different interpretations there too. So I think the dissolution of the American dream is perceived on the right as being intimately tied up with the demographic changes, and that the pie isn't big enough for everyone to get a slice, and so we have to compete along racial lines. And then on the left, it's more of a structural analysis. The American dream is slipping away because we've structured our economy in a way that gives unequal slices of the pie to different groups.
So in many ways, I think that, John, that the Trump supporters are a complex lot. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is clearly this overarching racial and racist sentiment among many Trump supporters. Then you look at these independents, who a minority of those independents, a majority of those independents would move away from Trump to support Sanders. And there's something about the non-ideologicalness, if there's such a word. The non-ideologicalness of most Americans, I think, which is why they can sway between Sanders and Trump, especially in the white community. I mean, how do you read that?
Yeah, I mean, I think we make a mistake if we assume that everybody is playing politics according to the same rules that we've established for ourselves and the same categories we've established for ourselves. I mean, certainly there is a lot of very explicit xenophobic, racist resentment and desire for revenge among Trump supporters. But there is also, I think, a growing analysis among a lot of people at a very base level, at a level that's not terribly, it's not because they've read a whole bunch of books about political economy, but because they feel it in their everyday lives, that something is deeply wrong with the way this country is delivering for everyday people in terms of jobs, in terms of security for the future. And I think that sense of insecurity is really shaking things up and scrambling our the kind of political narratives that we're used to. At the same time that we have this, person who's saying things that would have been totally outrageous in terms of racism, in terms of misogyny, and having all this surprising traction. And then on the other hand, having somebody who's avowed socialist being able to run in the presidential election pretty credibly in the primary, it's a very different world ideologically and a very different terrain.
But do you think Bill Fletcher, in some ways, think about what both Zoe and John just said, that when we use our typical political analysis from the left or the right or anywhere like that, that somehow it's missing the mark of what's happening here. I mean, why most Americans are moving the way they're moving. That maybe I didn't say that correctly, because in analysis you are kind of figuring out why people are moving the way they're moving. But people are moving not because of ideology, but because of something much deeper.
Maybe I'm a hardliner, Mark.
But that's okay.
I mean, I've been accused of that, obviously. But you see, it seems to me that when you look at the Trump supporters, the defining feature is race. It really is race. Because just think about it for a second. This man has been articulating politics that are completely irrational. He's been lying. He's been exaggerating things. He repeats lies. He is a birther. And he's not being called out on that. I mean, the people that say that Trump is speaking for them because they're angry, I would say, well, then why aren't you supporting Bernie Sanders? I mean, if you're really angry with the system, why aren't you supporting Bernie Sanders? What is it about Trump that attracts you? And you keep hearing similar things. He says what is really on his mind.
Mm-hmm.
Saying what we feel. Well, what is it that we feel? Well, what is it that some of us feel is that America, quote-unquote, has been lost to the other, however you want to define the other. And Trump is speaking to that. And I feel that, unfortunately, Sanders, who I support, has not hammered away at that piece of what is so central in terms of Trump. So I actually don't think that I think that what we're seeing is surprising on one level, but it's also consistent with things that we're seeing in other parts of the global north, particularly as two things are unfolding. One is, and they're related, one is the reconstruction of global capitalism, and the second is unprecedented levels of migration.
Those are major factors. I think that and maybe the what you term as the reconstruction of global capitalism, mm-hmm. is one of the reasons why the quote unquote American dream cannot be realized.
That's right.
Right?
Yeah.
It's impossible to realize it. And that, though some people on the left would argue that around the Bernie's camp, I think that it may be impossible, and maybe that's what people are feeling. On both sides of the divide, in their kind of detesting what government and society is now.
Well, I mean, it's, you know, a lot of the American dream was built on cheap oil and cheap natural resources. The world is changing, even though oil right at this moment has decreased. That's not a long term thing, and we're looking at also an environmental catastrophe that necessitates a real rethinking of the economy. People feel all of these things, and they're looking for answers, and they're looking for direction. What Trump offers is delusion. He offers a bubble, a delusional bubble that you can enter into, within which everything that's irrational seems to make sense.
Zoe, I mean, So extrapolate from that and take where we might be going.
Well, just to make a point about...
No, any point you'd like. Go right ahead.
the American dream. I think it's true. It was built on an abundance of natural resources, but it was also built on a form of government intervention that stepped in certain situations to provide a safety net and on infrastructure and things like that. And we've really gone backwards in that respect. It was also built on the gradually strengthening labor rights and labor unions, which also has waned. So it's not just a feature of these sort of external factors that we don't have control over. And I think that's one thing that people are sort of waking up to, and what partly is explains the Bernie Sanders moment is like, hey, we've been told this story about the economy getting better and, you know, the numbers look really good, but our actual lived experiences aren't matching up with that. And I think that's one of the things that explains not just the Sanders moment, actually, but also why economic factors, opposition to trade deals and things like that have, and also than the racial dimension, have proven to be more essential for Trump supporters than, for example, their affiliation with evangelical groups. That's another way in which the normal way of thinking about ideology has been scrambled this year, is that the sort of religious right, who you would think would have anointed Ted Cruz, that coalition hasn't proven to be as strong. And also, I think it's a great point in terms of where we're going to look at this in a global context, to look at Trump in the context of the rise of the far right in Europe, in Hungary, in Germany, in Greece, and to think about this xenophobia and the way it animates politics as being not just unique to the U.S.
So we should take a quick break here. Take a very quick break and come right back. We'll come back to John Duda and look at the – and I want to hear from you out there, 410-319-8888. Your thoughts on this, on where America is going. Can if racism and xenophobia is at the core of a lot of this, can the gap be bridged? Is it possible in this country? And we look at even the gap inside the Democratic Party going on right now between black, Latino, and white voters and where that's taking us. And so we'll analyze all that more and get to your calls at 410-319-8888 and email us here at talkatsteinershow.org. Welcome back. Good to have you all here. We're here with Bill Fletcher, Jr., senior scholar of the Iowa Institute of Policy Studies, editorial member of BlackCommentator.com, Zoe Carpenter, The Nation's Magazine's assistant Washington editor, John Duda, co-founder of BASE, and co-founder and collective member of Red Emma's. And you all to 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. Tweet us at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. You were going to say what, John, as we're going to break?
You know, I was going to say that it's really interesting to look at this international context and to look what's playing out in the U.S. right now is playing out all across the globe, and especially as Bill noted in the global north, where you have this kind of strange rise at the same time of economic populism on the left that's doing surprisingly well in places like the U.K., Labour Party elections in Spain. And then you also have this, you know, terrifying rise of, you know, naked authoritarianism in Turkey and Hungary, just now in the Philippines. And I think what's really interesting is that where populism has been able to succeed the most is where it's developed a politics that delivers for people in their everyday lives. So if you look at the rise of Syriza in Greece, it was tied to like networks of mutual aid, direct support, helping people actually deal with this economic crisis that was, you know, basically ruining their lives and giving them no hope for the future. The same thing in Spain, where you have this tremendous movement around housing rights and, you know, fighting back against foreclosure and eviction in these very direct, very powerful ways that's now translated into political power in places like Barcelona. And I think that's one of the challenges for us right now is how do we build that? How do we build an alternative that doesn't just get – that gets us out of this kind of, you know, theater of you know, illusion that Trump offers people and gives them some real hope?
So, Zoe, let me pick up and then we'll go to Bill and open the phones here. I mean, I think that I was seeing the other side of the equation as John was talking as well, which is if you look at the Democratic Party at this moment, there's a very weird and strange split going on. While Bernie Sanders has gotten maybe from Leah Wright Rigueur's research of the vote from Harvard University, 43% of African-American Democrats under the age of 30 supported Sanders. Though in many places, and he won in Wisconsin with the black vote, and the young black vote in Michigan helped push him over the top as well. But the reality is that the bulk of the African American community is going with Hillary Clinton, and in some weird, strange ways, it seems to me what's happened is that the Democratic Party since 1970 has become the place where African Americans, many Latinos, and women have actually found political power, and so people say that's the establishment, as opposed to the upstarts who are – the majority of whom are white coming out of the Sanders campaign. And it makes for a very interesting and weird dichotomy. And I wonder how that fits into this equation of where the progressive movement goes.
Well, I think it's certainly true that the Democratic Party more than the Republican Party has been the place where people of color and other minorities have found power. But it's not very much power. And I think I mean,
what'd you say, Zoe? Not very much power.
Right. Look at the representation. Look at the number of women of color in the Senate, for example. I think Donna Edwards has lost.
Yes.
A real moment for the party, as she pointed out in her speech after that loss, to say, look, you're the party that relies on the support of black women of color, of Latinos, of a variety of other groups that are not equally represented in the highest levels of office. And so gatekeepers stand aside. And I think that's going to be a real moment, a real issue for the party going forward, is that, yes, so far, the Democrats have been able to rely on that support. But, you know, they've been promising a certain level of representation that I think people are getting impatient with because it's been slow to come. And I think especially for the younger generation of activists, Black Lives Matter activists, for example, they're not as interested in towing the Democratic Party's line in hopes of the promises of some representation. They're working on elections, for example, fighting back against Nita Alvarez in Chicago and getting her booted out of office.
Right.
But they didn't endorse her opponent, for example. So there's this real tension here with people being a little impatient for the promises of representation.
Bill, how do you see that?
You know, one of the things, Mark, my friend Carl Davidson says that...
Good old Carl Davidson.
Carl Davidson.
Yeah, yeah.
He says the Democratic Party is actually six parties. And I think that is how we need to understand it, that it is not, it's not a political party, and I've said this on earlier shows of yours,
mm-hmm.
not a political party in the way that most of the rest of the world thinks a political party is. It's more like a coalition that calls itself a political party. Same for the Republicans, because of the nature of the U.S. electoral system. And so you have these different tendencies within the Democratic Party that are frequently at war with one another, and we're seeing that in evidence in this primary. And I think it was inevitable for a variety of reasons, and we have been watching the Democratic Party moving to the right, and a lot of people are revolting against that, and that's good. Now, having said that, there's two things I wanted to just throw into this mix. One is from this Katha Pollitt piece about why she ended up voting for Hillary.
Right. I remember that, yeah.
Which I thought was really interesting and actually quite courageous. Even though I disagree with her in terms of her decision, what she was saying is very, very important, and it's something that I and other people have been arguing, that the missing ingredient in the Sanders campaign is the linkage of gender and race to his narrative. And that failure to make that linkage, I think, has a lot to do with why many African Americans were skeptical and have been skeptical of the Sanders campaign, because we've heard white populists before tell us that a rising tide raises all boats, and not wanting to speak about race. And we've seen the results. Now, just one other quick thing.
Sure.
One thing that is not being discussed, and I can't quite figure out why this is, Mark, is that if Sanders gets the nomination by some chance, there will be red baiting unlike anything that we have seen in our lives. It will take us back to the 1940s and early 50s. And I actually don't think people are ready for it. And many of these alleged independent voters that say that they will vote for Sanders over Trump, I'm actually skeptical of that if there is the kind of red baiting that I anticipate would happen. And the movement, the progressive movement, needs to be very prepared and start thinking now about how to address this, because when you're dealing with an opportunist like Trump, I mean, he's already red-baited Sanders.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think we're acting like we're in a fool's paradise.
That last comment you made, Bill, I've thought about as well. I mean, I think that, as my wife has been saying to me a lot, Valerie's been saying a great deal, do not discount a Trump victory in this election, specifically that being one of the reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that analysis is really important. I don't weigh the phones, John. You want to comment on what the last two just said?
Yeah, I mean, I think everybody's getting really excited by these polls that are coming out that are saying, you know, millennials don't want capitalism anymore, right? And it's by a very, very slim margin, which is remarkable, right? And the fact that a third of 18 to 29-year-olds in the country are like, yes, I'd like socialism, please. That's really, really remarkable, and it's a real change. But it's, I think Bill's right to point out, we're not out of the danger zone yet here. Just because a quarter of the country wasn't alive during the Soviet Union, didn't live through that, didn't get a politics that was, a sedimented politics that was formed by that intense anti-communism. That doesn't mean that 3/4 of the population, you know, is still working within that frame.
Oh, no. I can see people then making this connection between IS and communists, a danger to the world.
Yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And the xenophobia is very real. I mean, you look at the reaction throughout the Western world, as Zoe was saying. The election of Khan in London has cost – I mean, even during that election, how he was baited as a soft on terrorism and all the rest. And, you know, I think that that same mindset is throughout the Western world. Let's see what our listeners are thinking at 410-319-8888. Let's go to Robert on line 4. You're on the air.
Hello.
Morning.
Oh, let me turn this down. Okay. Just basically, I'm just wondering, and now you can share your thoughts with me on this. Could this, what we see going on now, indicate that the country may be moving toward a certain fork in the road?
Describe what you mean by a fork in the road.
Well, that is, I mean, the bankruptcy of both parties is becoming increasingly evident to larger and larger numbers of people. And there's anger on both the left and the right. So it may be that the days of establishment politics, whether it's the so-called liberal politics, so-called, of the Democratic Party, or even the conventional conservative politics of the Republican Party, is losing legitimacy. And then you get to a point, maybe, where society has to take some fundamentally different turns. Now, the turn could be some ugly. We saw, I mean, historically that happened in Europe, you know, in Italy and Spain and Germany, right? Or is it possible that the country could take a more democratic, humane turn, which will recapture what Cornel West likes to call our deep democratic traditions? I'm wondering if we're not reaching a fork in the road where we could take a more liberating path or a darker path. And I wonder if we're fully, I don't know what to say, fully aware or cognizant of what challenges this might offer us.
I mean, that's an interesting point, and I think, Zoe, I mean, you cover D.C. and American politics all the time, and so I just, you know, I think that we may be at a fork in the road, but I think it may be more like Robert Johnson's crossroads.
I think certainly the idea that the country could emerge from this election either looking more progressive or more authoritarian is certainly true. However, the country is always going to be divided in some ways, and it's always going to be really multifaceted in its political and ideological leanings. I do think that, you know, the idea that we could actually go to a darker side and towards authoritarianism isn't something to be discounted, because although you know, we were talking about this a little bit before the question, although Trump's election to the presidency seems unlikely given the demographics of the country and given the way the polls are looking now. Polls are never sure, and demographics only matter if people turn out to vote. And there could be some event that we have no control over, for example, a terrorist attack or a severe economic downturn between now and the election that would really reshape the field in a dramatic way. And so I think we can't discount the idea that the election will swing at least the White House to a more authoritarianism side. I think the other question is what happens down the ballot, because we talk so much about the presidential election, but a lot of the actual policies that get made are getting made in state houses. So I think whether the country as a whole is getting more progressive or more authoritarian, the patchwork is really much more mixed across the country. It varies by state. And by city.
Bill, I mean, on this notion that our caller Robert Burt said about the fork. I mean, I think in many ways when I made the comment about Robert Johnson and what Zoe was just saying, is because we are a nation that's pulling apart in many different directions, and there doesn't seem to be any center forces to kind of pull any of those pieces together.
We never resolved the Civil War, Mark.
Right, exactly.
I mean, fundamentally, that's the apparition that haunts us and has since 1865, that we've never resolved certain basic conflicts because of the way that the Civil War itself ended and Reconstruction was destroyed. And so we're living with that. And I think that Zoe's right that the country is divided, but it's always been divided. What's different is that the methods of communications we have now are near instantaneous. So what would have taken days or weeks to find out once upon a time, now you find out within seconds or minutes. And so that has an impact on a growing level of anxiety that people are feeling. And I think that the caller is, I agree with the caller, that I think that we're at a couple of different crossroads, actually. And one is based on the environmental crisis that essentially demands that we rethink the economy in some fundamentals, which is precisely why many Republicans are into climate denial, because they don't want to rethink the economy. But I think we're also looking at, as I said earlier, potential realignment. When you have conservatives talking about Trump is not one of them,
right,
and they
right.
may sit home or at least not participate in the presidential race, this is very significant. And every so often in U.S. history, there are political realignments, either voter realignments or where you actually have the emergence of new political parties and forces, and we could be on the verge of that.
I mean, it does, in some ways, John Duda, for me, feel like that, and it seems like that analytically when we look at the past and where we've come. And this is because we always think of these moments as being the moment, but to me, there are very few the moments.
That's right.
More of a continuum that keeps growing and changing, and I think that America, in many ways, has never, for want of a better term at the moment, recovered from the revolts of the 50s and 60s led by Black America and the Civil Rights Movement, spawning the movement against the war in Vietnam, spawning the women's movement in the 1960s, and the deindustrialization, which destroyed the unions, which was one place that was the basis for some power. I mean, so that and I think and also it kind of blew up the American dream of, you know, that, no, George Washington didn't chop down the cherry tree, right? And nothing has replaced it.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of where we are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think a new narrative that brings together a whole bunch of different struggles and different anxieties and different, you know, fears about the future into a program that, you know, that people can actually believe in is really vital. I mean, going back to that Civil War example, you had this brief moment after the Civil War where the self-activity of enslaved people to free themselves created this whole political space. And Dave Roediger has talked about this, where you have, you know, the possibility of the labor movement.
Who spoke about it?
Dave Roediger.
Roediger, yeah. I'm sorry.
So the possibility of the labor movement, the possibility of feminism were all created out of this moment of abolition. And then that incipient, like, amazing coalition tore itself apart. And I think that, you know, we need to look towards that kind of structure. We need to have a way of bringing all of these things together in the same way that the Civil Rights Movement created this huge political space that you were just talking about. I don't see that exactly happening at this moment, and that really worries me, because I think we are in a crisis point. And it's not a crossroads. It's not a fork in the road, like where we're sitting at the fork in the road and thinking, oh, do we want to go down that way or that way, you know, scratching our chin. And, you know, we're being driven towards a point where this system may break down. And when systems break down, they go one way or the other, and it's a very, very unpredictable process. If it was predictable, the system would still be working.
Zoe, you want to jump in on this before I open the phones again?
I'll just say, on the point about the need to bring disparate discontent and hopes and dreams together, I think that's sort of what's motivating the Moral Monday movement and this attempt at reinvigorate fusion politics in North Carolina with Reverend Barber. And that's the fusion movement isn't new, but it's something that I think they're hoping to expand across the country to capture this particular opportunity, which is not, of course, exactly like abolition in the Civil War, but it is a similar sort of moment of crisis.
Let me open the phones here, 410-319-8888. Let us go to Leo. You're on the air. Welcome.
Yes. Good morning, Mark Steiner.
Leo Burrows, how are you, brother?
I'm great. Good morning to you and your guests. Of course, I'm looking forward cynically to 8 more years of Hillary and Bill Clinton. You know, what a stale do-over we're going to have. I mean, they're going to do what is politically expedient and not move us forward. I like Bernie Sanders because he's advocating institutional change. I hear what you guys are saying, and I understand it, but I at least like the fact he's telling the truth in a blatant way that we have to address. We need a revolution damn bad. You know, we really do. A genuine revolution. Voter suppression is alive and well. Institutional racism is alive and well. And what does Trump represent? Well, he's the new Nazi. You know, he's German, and he's our new Adolf Hitler. This Donna Edwards situation really blew my mind, Mark. I must tell you, of black people who allowed themselves to be manipulated. I saw Elijah Cummings and Joanne Benson, state senators, and Kathleen Kennedy Townsend and Senator Dolores Kelly and others go for the okey-doke in terms of deposing or opposing Donna Edwards on the basis that she allegedly was not qualified. How outrageous is that? I mean, that, again, the Democratic Party is going down the road toward oblivion, obviously. I don't know where we're going, but we better free ourselves from the shackles of institutional racism in this country. It is alive and well.
Leo, thanks so much for that.
And what about Heather Mazur, the white woman who's a gay activist who says she's against Donna Edwards? Can you imagine a white woman gay activist legislator against Donna Edwards? I can't get my arms around it other than the fact that race must have trumped her gayness.
So you've written about this in The Nation's written about this magazine. Why don't you pick up on that before we take a break here, and I want to hear what Bill has to say about that as well.
On the institutional racist?
Yeah, and the whole Donna Edwards piece. But that fits into, I think, the discussion we've been talking about.
Well, you know, it's a difficult situation. Van Hollen obviously was not a conservative. He had some progressive bona fides. But I think, you know, a lot of Donna Edwards supporters just felt like she was so much more in touch with the working people that she wanted to support. I think the point that I made before, basically, about the gatekeeper stands true. A lot of people who work with candidates of color feel like one of the big barriers is that the gatekeepers view them as unelectable or unqualified or not able to raise enough money because they don't have ties to super wealthy communities, and so they see them as being non-viable. Obviously, Donna Edwards had proved that she was a viable candidate in other races, but I think it's certainly even more challenging as you get into the smaller races that have less of a national profile.
I think that we have a few minutes. Did you want to jump in this, Bill? I thought we were at the top of the hour, not yet. Bill?
Yeah. I think we need to be careful about what conclusions we jump to in the Donna Edwards Van Hollen race. First of all, there were no significant political differences between the two candidates. So it's not like you had a progressive running against a Democratic Leadership Council type person. There were differences, but the differences were not all that significant. Van Hollen was someone who was positioned, had been positioned to jump, to run into this seat. And I think that there were some mistakes that were made in the Edwards campaign. But I think that what the campaigns ended up really getting into, which was important, relates to something that Zoe was saying. It's a different, like, there's like a storyline. There's a storyline that Donna's campaign was articulating, which I think was very important and really did resonate and does resonate with a lot of folks about the way that this society is operating and the transformation in the political realm that needs to take place. And I think that was important.
And we have to understand that within the so-called Democratic Party, these are precisely the types of fights that we're going to have to anticipate. And I would argue we're going to have to advance, that it's not simply about sitting back and just voting for Democrats because we don't like Republicans. It is about advancing politicians that really are promoting, articulating our concerns and our story. And I think that Donna is one of them. And I think that Sanders is one of them, but Sanders has this weakness. And that is why it is incumbent upon us to really be speaking out about issues of race and gender, because otherwise we have a situation where we hear it again and again, a rising tide raises all boats, and history demonstrates that that's flawed.
We have to about take – it's time for us to take this break. We're going to take a break here and go to NPR News. I just – closing out the Donna Edwards piece, my own thoughts on that real quickly is I had conversations with so many people during that campaign and saying that all things being equal, allegedly if they were all equal in terms of the politics where people stood, isn't it important alone to have a voice in the U.S. Senate be the voice of a black woman, progressive, who had raised her own child on her own and had a lot to say to the world. Does that make a difference? I mean, I think that's something people have to really wrestle with here. We're going to do a very short break. NPR News, come back with our panel to conclude this conversation, get to your calls, Clarence and Marie, the next two callers up at 410-319-8888. Stay with us. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and welcome back to our conversation here about what this Trump versus Clinton or Sanders really means, what's underneath of it, where America's going, and where our country is going, and what this, how this election defines some of that for us. We're here with Zoe Carpenter, The Nation's Magazine's assistant Washington editor, John Duda, co-founder of BASE and co-founder and collective member of Red MS Bookstore and Coffee House here in Baltimore, Bill Fletcher Jr., who is senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies on the editorial board of editorial board member of blackcommentator.com, co-author of numerous books, The Indispensable Ally and Solidarity Divided being two of them, and you at 410-319-8888. We're going to go right to the phones here, but let me just throw something out. I just said to John Duda, you know, before I was, Bill, before I was, before the show, I was reading some articles, and one of them was Valerie, my wife, sent me, was from the Military Times, and they did a poll of American troops. Where 50 of, and it wasn't, they're not saying it was a scientific poll, but it was a poll they took. 54% of the troops they polled said they would vote for Donald Trump. 25% said Clinton. 21% they would stay out of the, abstain from voting altogether. I didn't see anything about Sanders, but that's a significant number to me. That 54% of now our professional armed forces say they would vote for Donald Trump. What does that say to you, Bill?
It says that we're paying the price for the elimination of the draft and for the infiltration into the military of very jingoistic right-wing elements over the years who are promoting a very, very dangerous direction. Now, one of the things to keep in mind at the same time, Mark, is that at the top of the military, there is great distrust of Trump and worry in the Pentagon. There are many indications that there is an uneasiness with what a Trump presidency would mean, just as there was with a Cruz presidency.
And I just did find as we were speaking, it said in a matchup between Trump and Sanders. It changed from 51% for Donald Trump and 38% for Sanders, 11% not voting among the military. I just thought that was very significant polling numbers just in terms of where our military might be. And again, this has to do with this widening divide. Zoe, would you want to comment on that before we open the phones again?
I'll just say I think it also demonstrates that what has been the prevailing doctrine of foreign policy on the right, which is neoconservatism, is losing some of its power, at least among the electorate. Trump doesn't use those lines, although he is certainly bellicose and has threatened to course, he's also more of an isolationist than has been the norm in terms of wanting to disengage in certain areas. So it's striking that that what has been the dominant foreign policy consensus is not really holding true in Trump supporters.
Let me open the phones here, 410-319-8888, and Clarence, you're on the air. Welcome.
Steiner, can you hear me, sir?
We can. You're on the air.
You know, you guys, at the beginning of your program, you gave what I call a top-down model when you were talking about how the economic situation instills fear in the country and people. Let me give you the bottom-up model from a cab driver who doesn't have to earn a living driving a cab. I'm just out there, and I observe a lot. When I can go to the Washington Monument on a Sunday morning and 90% of the people there are white people who can afford that leisure activity, or come home and turn on a baseball game, or sit downtown in Baltimore City, and 90% of the folks that are going to the stadium are white people because they can afford that leisure activity, or even turn on the television, watch a football game or baseball game. When the people going to work, and I'm there every morning and I observe this, are white folks walking to work, the majority, I'd say 85 to 90% of them. And I ask myself, how does economics play into this? You know, this is the actuality on the ground that I see. So the argument about economic conditions instilling fear, it doesn't weigh with me because I'm looking at it from that perspective. So when you meet me in the middle from what you guys were saying at the beginning of the program, I say it's either just pure racism or somebody in the political system, a group of folks in the political system, use those topics as to instill fear to and keep the divisiveness going so that they can remain in power. There's no other way for someone like me to look at this because it doesn't make sense from what I see. Now, Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton, I still think Bernie Sanders is a snake oil salesman. But Hillary Clinton, to me, is just as sinister as Donald Trump when you look at the history, I mean, in detail. And that's why I'm in self-protect mode. I voted for Bernie Sanders, but right now I'm in self-protection mode. I really don't even think that I will bother about voting because the only thing I'm looking for now at this point in my life is food and shelter. And it's gotten to the point where I don't see I see black folks and minorities in a very, very bad situation because Hillary Clinton, as I said, is a sinister person to me. She just won't be out front with it. Thank you, Mr. Stein.
Thank you so much. Bill Fletcher?
Well, I mean, look, I agree with a lot of what the caller is saying, and that the reality is that we need a fundamental transformation in this country. What we have to understand, though, is that the election is more than just about the president. It is about not only, and it's also more than just about the other seats that are open, all of which are very important. It's the symbol of who ends up taking over. When you have someone who is legitimizing violence against their opponent, you're not going to be safe, caller. No matter where you hide, you're not going to be safe. When you have someone that legitimizes violence against immigrants, basically saying that, you know, my supporters are overly enthusiastic, that is incredibly dangerous. So there's a lot at stake in this election. The problem is that we can't just rely on the election. And this is where we have to be thinking, not just about November 2016, but we've got to be thinking about how do we actually build something that lasts, that speaks to the issues that the caller was raising.
John?
Yeah, I mean, I go back to, there was a great book by Steve Phillips that just came out. And
you can tell you that you run a bookstore.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. And he was making the point that, look, you know, a lot of people are talking about demographic changes and, you know, a a new kind of minority position for white people in this country, and that's coming down the pike, and that's great, but that doesn't mean we can just sort of sit and wait around for it to happen, that we need to really be thinking about how do we build an alliance, right? If we can put together the people who believe in a progressive vision of society, who are white, who believe in economic justice, and we could put those together with the folks who want to see communities of color empowered because that's their communities, and we can build an alliance that actually works across those two growing demographics, then we can really win, and we can keep winning, and we can win not just in a presidential election but in all sorts of contexts. But the challenge is that it's not automatic. There's a lot of work, and I think a lot of people have pointed out that the left is really far behind on this. We don't have a coordinated strategy. We don't have the deep organizing that's going to make this possible. We're really late to the party in a lot of ways, and we're going to be playing catch up and build. You know, I mean, if you look at what the right has in terms of grassroots infrastructure and its ability to sort of, you know, coordinate nationally and at the local level, it's far ahead of where progressive forces are.
Zoe, you cover that. What are your thoughts on what John just said?
Well, first of all, when we're thinking about the activist conservative groups, I think it's important to remember for this election, folks haven't even started spending their money yet. And so that could really have a huge impact that we haven't even thought about in terms of, especially because it's down ballot races, but also on the presidential election, although the presidency is the hardest, the most difficult to buy, as 2012 proved. I do think it's correct that the left has been behind establishing that infrastructure from the ground up. You know, we saw that in 2010 when the right was able to sweep into power in many states and then gerrymandered themselves into strongholds, places like North Carolina. And then you have philanthropic activist philanthropy, donations to universities that pay for special chairs in economics, teach conservative free market economics. And so I think the left is starting to wake up to that. But, you know, that was a 40-year project. And so it's not like we're just going to be able to suddenly put in place equal infrastructure to match that.
Let me get a call in here, and we can get some final thoughts from our guests about where we think this is going to go. Not that anybody's really prescient, has a crystal ball, but we'll do that. 410-319-8888. Let's go to Bill. You're on the air.
Yes, first let me just say hello to everybody. And 3 points, if I can. The cab driver made some very good points, and I'm basically still the same way. But, you know, I think another thing is that, you know, I think I said this to you once before, Mark. I mean, why we don't have a process, why can you have somebody run for president that advocates violence and hate, and there's no process of elimination to make sure this person's not disqualified if this country cannot promote that kind of activity itself? Secondly, somebody said something about Don Edwards and don't jump to conclusions, but sometimes you can't help from jumping to conclusions, Mark. When we don't have no black governor today, we don't have enough of maybe one black U.S. senator today, then you can't help from jumping to conclusions. You know, I heard somebody on this program, and it was making a point, and they didn't deliberately say it, but, you know, a lot of times when we say, well, when we getting ready to point to something that's getting ready to be bad, and we say we getting ready to go to the dark side, well, you know, we say that not meaning nothing bad, but why do we say the dark side? Why we don't say the white side? Because the dark side is a symbol of blackness that represents something evil. You see what I'm saying? Sometimes we've been programmed in a whole bunch of ways to say things that we don't really mean to say to hurt nobody, but we already been programmed. That's why we say the dark side, because we say that it's going to be something bad for us opposed to something good for us.
Bill, I think that could be a whole discussion for an hour by itself. I appreciate the call. Let's get a final thought from Marie, who's been waiting a long time, and then we'll get closing thoughts from our guests. Marie, welcome.
Good morning, and thank you so much for taking my call. I go for the previous caller, the cab driver. This is what I want to say. Last weekend, I was listening to another station, and was a female interviewer who was interviewing Pat Buchanan. And she asked Pat Buchanan, are the white males interested or concerned about their money? Well, us, and I'm sure the cab driver would too. Beck Buchanan's answer was, the white males are concerned about whiteness. And that's all I have to say. Thank you so much.
Marie, always good to hear from you. Thank you so much. Let's get closing thoughts here as we round out this conversation, which has been really fascinating. Zoe Carpenter.
Well, you know, I think that in terms of what's next for Bernie supporters, which is something we didn't talk about too much, I think.
Go ahead, please.
Looking ahead to the conventions, I think, you know, if it seems like Hillary is definitely the nominee, then I think the next step will be to try to make sure the party platform is as strong as possible on the progressive principles that he's drawn his support from.
I'd be interested. I do want to get into that. I think that will be a conversation we'll have in the coming weeks. I look forward to being part of that conversation. So we just where we're going to this convention and where it is going and what's going to happen once we get there, and interesting to see what happens in the coming races in California and the rest, which could be very telling whether it'll be an amicable one or a deep fight inside that convention, and where it takes the Democrats. Bill Fletcher.
I think that's going to be, building on what Zoe said, there's going to be a struggle around platform, but also the vice presidential candidate.
Yes.
Which I think would be very, very important and very telling and symbolic. I think that one of the things we have to keep in mind is that Hillary Clinton has been very much shaken by this primary season. Neither she nor the Democratic Party establishment ever could have predicted the kind of upsurge that has taken place, and she has been pushed to articulate things that she probably never would have in the past. But the other thing I'd say, Mark, is that I think it's important that particularly activists, people that are active in any way, that we start thinking not just about the presidential elections, but thinking long-term about other elections, local elections particularly, the state legislature, the governor, the next governor's race, et cetera. But we've got to be thinking about that and not remaining stuck in thinking that politics is only something you do once every 4 years.
Right. And let me go, but John Buda, I'm about to say something. John,
yeah.
Go ahead.
You know, I think we've got to figure out a way to not give in to the left's tendency to tear itself apart. The movement that we need to build is much bigger than any one candidate. And if we're going to have the capacity to push candidates, and it's possible, you know, FDR, when he was elected, was a well-connected dude who just really wanted to be president. And movements turned, you know, that into a progressive opening, not the other way around. So if we want to be able to do that, we need a strong movement. And that movement needs to be, if not unified, then at least able to work together across differences of opinion about strategy.
And I think one of the things we should think about is also what Zoe alluded to a little earlier, which is that looking across the country and looking at examples like Baltimore and other cities across the country where people may not self-identify necessarily as on the left, but there is a surge from the bottom up that is happening. You see that you saw it in the city council elections in Baltimore and the surge of young people who were elected that really – and the kind of ballot measures coming up in the city and other cities that show there's a force from democracy bottom up is building. So I think that's something that has to be discounted. We always look at the national elections. We're not looking very closely at some of the things that are happening across Wisconsin, California, Maryland, where local elections are really having an effect and where that might take all of this. So I do want to thank the three of you. It's been a great conversation. John Duda, see you at Red MS sometime soon. Good to have you here. Thank you so much.
Thanks,
Zoe
Mark.
Carpenter, the Nation's Assistant Washington Editor. Good to have you always on the show. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bill Fletcher, Jr., Senior Scholar of the Institute for Policy Studies, editorial member, board member of blackcommentator.com, and author and thinker. Bill, always good to have you with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we take a short break, and we come back. We're going to see what's happening in the city paper. Let me say, on the way to that break, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its member and its communities prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information at www.mecu.com. We'll be right back with Karen Hoopert, editor-in-chief of the Baltimore City Paper.